This season of My First Dungeon is sponsored by MythWorks. We absolutely loved working with MythWorks on our recent season of The Wild Sea, and we are thrilled to be working with them again on Slug Blaster. Our goal with this season is to make you fall in love with Slug Blaster just as much as we have. And if you do, you can go to myth.works and use the promo code MFD2025 to get 20% off your own copy of Slug Blaster. Again, that's code MFD2025. And also, on April 29th, MythWorks is launching a backer kit campaign for the first official Slug Blaster expansions. It's called Slime, Warp, and Solder, and it's a three-pack of fluorescent zines that will make your Slug Blaster sessions grosser, trippier, and radder than ever. So check out the link in the description or search for Slug Blaster, Slime Warp, and Solder on BackerKit to pre-save that campaign. And with that, let's blast some slugs! Hello and welcome to another season of My First Dungeon, the tabletop role-playing podcast that helps GMs learn new games and make each one better than the last. This season, we are kick-flipping over some quantum centipedes in Slug Blaster. I'm hanging out after school. High on life with my whole damn crew. We're gonna cruise our boards into the sunset. Mom and Dad don't understand. When I skate, the whole world's in my hands. That's how I know inside my bones I'm meant to be. What is Slug Blaster, you ask? Slug Blaster is a game about teenagehood, giant bugs, circuit bent ray guns, hoverboard tricks, and trying to be cool. It is dangerous, it is stupid, it has parent groups in a panic, and it is the coolest thing ever. And after our phenomenal campaign of The Wild Sea, we are once again sponsored by MythWorks. Thank you very much to them. I am Brian Flaherty, as ever, and I'm going to be the Slug Master for this season. And joining as a player this season and also joining as moderator for this conversation is none other than our very own Elliot Davis. Elliot.
Hello. I'm ready to blast some slugs.
Blast some slugs.
Blasting slugs. Hey, Brian, you excited?
I'm very excited. This game has been on our top couple list for we have a long running list at My First Dungeon of games we want to play. We only get to play a couple games a year, and Slug Blaster has been in the top three since we heard about it.
Oh yeah, oh my god. And I think you picked up the book at Gen Con, so it's been a little time coming.
Yeah, it's been sitting either on my shelf or next to my bed, alternating back and forth. I'm just like, okay, let's pull it back out, let's look a little more, let's pull it back out, let's look a little more, let's pull it back out, let's look a little more. So yeah, I'm very excited. I gotta go watch a couple episodes of Rocket Power and get back in that vibe.
Hell yeah. Well, Brian, before we get into the radness that is Slug Blaster, as always, you know that on this show, we want to set our GMs up for success by giving them access to the very best resources possible. And I can't think of a better resource than the designer of Slug Blaster himself, Mikey Ham. Mikey, welcome to the show. So good to have you.
Hey, guys. Nice to have me. Wait, no, let's redo that.
What we will say is that if it's too funny, we do have to keep it in.
So. Well, I'll tell you. Okay, guys. Keep it in and double it, right? I'll tell you what went wrong. I'm getting over a cold, and this whole time I was like, do I have to clear my throat before this intro, or can I get through a couple sentences? And I was so focused on just speaking in a human voice that I just...
I get it.
Anyways,
I've been there.
Thanks for having me, guys. I'm so happy to be here.
We're so happy to have you.
We're thrilled to have you. But that's not all, Brian.
What?
I got an extra special treat for you.
Oh my god, I love treats.
As you know, we were prepping for this Slug Blaster season, and we came across a group of people who have quite possibly played more Slug Blaster than anyone on the planet. They are the folks behind the actual play podcast, Quantum Kickflip. So we thought it would be extra fun to bring on one of their Slugmasters to share some inside GM tricks and get you even more set up for success. So please join me in welcoming to the show, Lena Anderson. It is so good to have you.
It is so good to be here. Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited.
Yeah, we're going to talk slugs.
So many slugs, so much blasting.
Look how smooth that intro was. Oh, wow.
Although I will have a very inflated ego and say, it is nice to have me.
Oh, see, now we have to keep it in. Now we have to.
Now we have to keep it in.
Oh, no!
Now
we've referenced it again.
It was my fault.
So I'm going to be asking Brian what he is nervous about in a second here. But first, could the two of you each, in one sentence, tell me what kind of story Slug Blaster is trying to tell?
Oh, boy. One sentence. Let's see. I'm going to use lots of M dashes in this sentence.
M dashes, commas, semicolons. Yeah, the whole all thing. Welcome.
Parentheses.
Slug Blaster is trying to tell the story of teenagers who are doing dangerous things to be cool and then dealing with the consequences of those actions at home later.
I would say that Slug Blaster is a story about teen experiences, teen angst, and teen drama heightened through interdimensional exploration and blasting slugs with ray guns.
Yeah, hell yeah, that's good. That was good.
Yeah, two solid sentences. Now, Brian, before I ask you what you're worried about, let's talk about the good stuff. What drew you to wanting to Slugmaster for this game that we're going to be playing?
I think anyone, this is an audio only medium, but anyone who sees this book will immediately understand how cool it looks. But also, like, I think ever since I was a kid, I was really into, like, you know, very DIY culture, skate. I was never a part of skate culture, but I have bought skateboards at a number of times in my life that are and are not age appropriate, and have always, like, loved that culture. You know, analog audio, you know, bike messengers, handmade, customized gadgets, Recess, Rocket Power, like, all of these things kind of together. And then you add in the teen angst and drama of a tabletop role-playing game. It's like, that's everything I wanted. And then you also get to kickflip over some quantum centipedes and blast some slugs like that. All of those things are really cool. It is wild and out there. I also, there's a bit in the book that I want to read verbatim because I found it today. I reread it today and I loved it. And it's describing the tone of the game. And the headline is "Make It Gonzo." And this is what it says. Listen, hard science fiction is great. Paper was invented so Neal Stephenson could use 60 pages to explain orbital mechanics. But that's not Slug Blaster. Slug Blaster is about cool words and pretty colors. It's about planar eclipses and neon slime. It's about slabs of falling crystal landing to create a ramp at the exact moment someone needs to 360 over a chasm filled with pink lava. That's the reason I want to play this game.
Yeah, no, I don't have no further questions, Your Honor.
I want to play the game, Elliot.
right. Okay. So now I'm gonna poke you a bit. So you want to play the game, but we've got these two wonderful people here who are gonna help make sure that you run it in the best possible way, set you up for success. What are the things that you are nervous about? How can Mikey and Lena help kind of alleviate what your watchouts are for going into this season with a new system?
I feel like I'm gonna lose some, like, indie TTRPG cred. I've never run a Blades in the Dark type game. And I've only played in a couple of sessions of Blades. So it's not a system I've read a lot of, you know, Forged in the Dark type games, but I have not played many of them. So, like, I don't have it in my bones what, you know, a 4-5 looks like and like necessarily, like, this is what a track looks like. Like, I know it, I get it, but I don't have it deep in my bones yet.
Yeah. You and me both, man. I don't know.
And then I think, you know, the big thing that I'm always looking for, you know, and part of this is me as a producer of, like, wanting to make a good show, but also me as a game master, is getting each player, we're going to have five players in this game, one for each of the playbooks in the game, is getting them each a satisfying arc and also having a satisfying arc for the crew as a whole. which is always tough. I feel like we always land the plane on this show,
mm-hmm.
but every at the start of the taxi, and you're always like, I don't know how we're going to do it. So anything that, you know, makes me feel a little bit easier and better about getting the plane back on the ground at the end is going to be great. And then there are just like a lot of, just like every game is the dumb thing is often the thing that is true. There's a lot of terms and things that I don't know yet. You know, we got boosts, we got kick, we got dares, we got tricks, we got slams, we got nope. And a lot of that is just
too many. There's way too many.
this interview will inspire a second edition from Mikey when we go through all the terms that Brian's worried about.
Oh, it's all right. I have a document that says for second edition that I just put any. I actually start that document in like the last like third of the design process for any game to keep me from like redesigning the game like late into the thing like too many times.
That's a good call.
And so I just like put things in there. I'm like, I'll just do this next time. And absolutely, like on the top, underlined is like too many terms, like, and just like a bullet point of like delete, like get rid of this. Like, just I'd love to strip this thing down like just 10% even. So, but you know, yeah, I don't know. It's just, but you know how it is. Each rule has a purpose at the time, and then. Sometimes it's not until you're like a couple years out from designing a game that you like all of a sudden are like, oh yeah, I see actually how this could have, like, you know, you just have to sort of, you need time sort of out of it. But I will say it's not too hard once you get in there, you know?
I think the thing I always say is like every new tabletop role-playing game is like a language. Like I know how to make jokes in D&D. I know how to make jokes in Orbital Blues. I don't know how to make a joke and like freestyle in Slug Blaster yet.
Yeah, you'll get there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, freestyle being an operative term.
A very operative term.
That's right. I was going to say, I do think that will probably be your only hurdle is learning the terms. Because other than that, like you said, you haven't played a lot of like Forge in the Dark stuff. I've had a number of people tell me that like Slug Blaster is a nice entry point into that stuff. And I know I designed Slug Blaster basically as I was designing it, I was constantly thinking like, what were the things I snagged on when I was first playing Forge in the Dark games? Like what are the things that I kept like, getting confused by? And I sort of tried to, design with like newbies in mind in that way. So I hope that aspect at least like goes smoothly for you. And I do feel like it's a pretty forgiving system, just like Forged in the Dark in general is. Like it's not like, not unlike like D&D or something. I mean, and this is half the fun of D&D sometimes, where like you might as a GM make a mistake and the players have this exploit and they kill the final boss in like one action or something like that, which can be fun but also can sort of sometimes ruin a scene or whatever. Mm-hmm. That kind of stuff doesn't happen in Forged in the Dark in the same way. It's like there's a lot more padding and sort of elasticity to it. So as a GM, you have a number of like sort of tools you can use to kind of narratively like pad or stretch out things or ramp up the difficulty or ramp it down. You sort of have some like a few basic controls that you can use on the fly. So I think just sort of knowing the rules just for guiding the players through the game is going to be the big thing. But actually like using those rules to create like a good like action scene or story, I don't think you're going to have a problem.
Love it.
So let's dive into this. We're throwing this term Forged in the Dark around a lot. Like when we're looking at Slug Blaster, what is the core mechanic we're going to be dealing with? What are the things we're going to be doing that are moving the session forward as we're playing?
Yeah, totally. So it's just it's a D6 roll that the player's going to take anytime they perform any action. That is where, you know, failure could be interesting, right? Or like, so, you know, anything that's, I have a little chart there, but, you know, climbing a ladder does not require a roll, but climbing a ladder while being shot at by lasers would require a roll.
Sure.
Or could. Depending if the GM thinks that would be like an interesting time to really test this player's, like to see if something bad happens, right? So anytime something like seems like a risky situation, they roll a D6. or in a lot of cases, they'll roll multiple D6 and pick the highest, right? It's a D6 pool. And then, yeah, as you mentioned, Forge in the Dark, sort of the sort of main thing about it is it breaks down those rolls into these three categories. Sixes are complete successes. Fours and fives are you succeed, but there's a problem. And then one to three results are you fail and there's a problem, right? So that's sort of that would be the core backbone of the game is those action rolls.
All right. So I do want to start picking at some of these terms.
Yeah.
If we can get into them.
Sure.
When we're looking at a character sheet, like what are the key terms that Brian needs to know to be able to kind of direct the players when they have questions? What are the ones that he's going to be using all the time?
Yeah, so he's going to be using the term problem a lot. A problem is just like a consequence from a role, like either a 1 to 3 or a 4 to 5. There'd be a problem, capital P, that he introduces. Problems can come in a lot of different forms. They could be like sort of interesting twists or complications in the scene that come up, but they could also just be like damage, right? In Slugblaster, they're called that. Damage is called a slam. So the players can take a certain amount of slams, and if they take too many slams, they're knocked out of the action, right? In Slug Blaster, there is this sort of in-world phenomenon called peelback, which if these teenagers, when they're out in the multiverse, when you're traveling in the multiverse, things are a bit unstable, and heightened amounts of stress can cause you to be peeled back to your home universe, and it's like a very traumatic process that, you know, adults rarely survive, and but teenagers can because of their more plastic brains. But it's like not a fun thing. It would be like the equivalent of a very serious sort of a skateboarder taking like a very serious injury that you might have to call like an ambulance for, like not a fun, like, oh, he broke his arm type injury, but like a little bit more serious one.
The fun one. Yeah.
Yeah. The fun one, you know, fun breaking arm injury. Yeah. Right. So it's sort of depending on the tone, exact tone you pick for your campaign, you know, but it's supposed to be sort of a serious thing. Yeah. So for example, if you take too many slams, you might peel, your character would peel back and be taken out of the action, and there'd be a greater consequence for peeling back and in the narrative and stuff. But yeah, so that's going to be, problems are going to be a main one the GM uses a lot. They're also going to say, you know, action. An action is, like I said, it's just doing a role. There are no skill categories or ability scores in Slug Blaster. You just roll an action for any type of thing you want to do. It's always the same. So you can do any task you can basically accomplish, your character can try to do, but the way that your character might be better or worse at certain things, comes down to your personality type and a resource you have called attitude, which is basically a pool of extra dice, that you'll see on your sheet, these little dice icons. And basically you can choose to check those off and add dice to your roll, right? So instead of rolling 1d6 to climb that ladder, as we talked about, while being shot at, if you were the grit personality, you could check off one of your attitude boxes and add another dice to that roll, and you're rolling 2d6 now and taking the highest, and you're describing it as, you know, I grit my teeth and I climb even though the laser bolts are scorching past my face, you know, like you really delve into like, okay, so what is it about your personality that's helping you accomplish this better? Whereas, you know, a different character might, you would have a different, with a different personality might describe them using that, those extra dice differently, right? So that's so that's called boost. Anytime you add a dice to your roll, you're adding, like, you're boosting it. So that's called boost. And then kick is the other kind of thing you can add to your roll. And basically what it does is it in D&D terms, you know, boost would be like a bonus to your d20 roll, and kick would be like a bonus to your damage. So in Slug Blaster, kick just increases the impact of your success, right?
Got it.
if you succeed and you've added kick, you succeed harder. You know, you get a critical, you get some sort of side benefit, right? So it's sort of like, yeah, like you're betting more chips, right? Yeah, that those are the two things you can add, and you get pools of those things based on your personality and also based on your signature device, right? Your signature device also has those little icons on it on the sheet that you can tick off, right? And so you can, and in Slug Blaster, you can pretty much stack anything. So you can decide if you want, you could save all your stuff until the very last roll of the session and then mark it all off and roll like six dice and, you know, just 360 no scope that slug and you're done, right?
As a GM, I've had some players try and do some really gonzo moves, and I have asked for up to three kicks sometimes.
Yeah. Oh, wow. So that's the other thing, is kick can be something that the player elects to use if they have an idea for how they'd want to use that extra. So like, you know, in straightforward example, let's say they're just, you know, fighting a slug, and they might just be like, I'm going to add some kick because I want to do a little more damage with when I shoot this thing. But then, on the other hand, a GM can also ask for kick as sort of a negotiation tactic if a player is trying to do something that seems a little like unlikely or like kind of hard to do. The GM might be, or like they're maybe asking to do a little too much with their action or their turn.
Right.
The GM could be like, sure, yeah, okay, but if you add a kick, I'll let you try that. Right. And right. That's just sort of a resource the GM can use to be like, yeah. But you know, because the idea with kick and boost and all this stuff is it's less of like it's not a simulationist, like in-world resource. It's like a narrative storytelling resource, right? These are moments of spotlight on these characters, right? More than anything. So it's, the GM can negotiate with that and be like, okay, you know, if this player, if they really want this, like if this is the moment they want to have, then it doesn't break the tone of the game. It's not doing something unfair to the other players. So, I'm going to let them go for it, but they're going to have to spend some of their stuff, because then that means they won't be able to just keep having all the awesome moments. It'll be the other players will get some next time. Right.
Right.
It's sort of like, you know, it's that kind of currency in a lot of ways. So
Lena, from your experience, do you have an example like that we can tie to this, like this idea of kick that you would say like kind of help summarize one of those gonzo moments where you had to ask for something like three kick? Where does that come from?
Yeah, what does three kick look like?
Okay, it's maybe a little niche, but
we love
the three kick scenario I was specifically thinking about was one of my players, David Ray, in season two. We were in Operablum, which is the cyberpunk dystopia dimension, mm-hmm. In a nutshell. And he was playing a robot, and he was trying to convince other robots that he was a human. And at first I said, Dave, I love your creativity and I love you as a friend. This is not going to work. And he's like, okay, but I want to do it. And that is where I said, okay, before you even roll, I need three kick on this.
Like, very good.
That's so good.
But yeah.
Did it work?
He rolled a six.
I'm mad about it
to this day.
Yeah, and then Lena, I forget exactly how you did it, but you're able to take something like that if that kind of stuff was happening every session, even, it might start like straining the, you know, the tone of the game or something like that, or the reality mm-hmm. of the world. But because it's not going to happen that often, because you're asking such a hefty price, and that way you're able to take these kind of, you know, it's like how they say in stories, like you're only allowed to have one coincidence happen, right? It's kind of like that
sure.
idea. Like, I mm-hmm. think of this, it's like you took that and you're like, hey, this is ridiculous, but if we roll with it and by asking for three kick and doing this, we're like putting a lampshade on it that like, yes, this moment is ridiculous, but this is why it happened. And then this is what came out from out of it. Right. And it's like, it's really mm-hmm. saying like, yes, this is ridiculous. This is not the normal tone of the game. This is like a crazy thing that happened, and yeah. let's unpack it. Right.
And it can also be like, you know, I want to race to the checkpoint, shoot the slug, do a backflip, and capture it all on video. And then it's like, okay, we're going to need some kick to make sure that you can do all of those things in one roll instead of in like the four rolls that it would make sense to do. It's just like very wacky, silly things, like trying to convince other robots that you are not a robot.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, that's the other thing about Forged in the Dark games is that there is no set like round length or even a set scope for what one action could be. So like, for example, in Blades in the Dark, like the example he uses that is that you might have a combat where you decide you want to go blow by blow and have players, you know, roll for every punch. But you also might decide sometimes that you want to resolve an entire gang fight with one roll, right? And in that case, that action roll is to represent, you know, the is for the player representing their character like fighting throughout that entire battle. So Slug Blaster theoretically is the same. Now, I think most tables find that they fall into a kind of set consensus of like what an action can be, like a length of an action. And I mean, let's be honest, it probably closely mimics like a 6-second D&D round just because that's where a lot of people come from, right? Like, and so, but you can stretch it or change it. Like you have that freedom to be like, okay, guys, let's all just do one roll to simulate like fighting off all these, you know, laser flies or whatever, right? And you can, you can do that if you think that that's the pace the game needs in that moment or whatever, right?
Yeah, we've had montages before that have been resolved by single rolls. So yeah, they're very, very versatile in that way.
I've had a player roll an action to stretch their hand. They were pinned down. I've had them roll an action to stretch their finger like 2 centimeters to tap a button on their phone, right? Like that, I made that be an action that they had to do that, right? To see if that could happen. So like you can really zoom in if it's like an important thing. And in that case, it was like an important phone tap that changed the course of the scene, right?
Very flexible. Yeah. That's great. Brian, are there any other like terms that you want to make sure we dig in on?
You know, there is one term that, because I think there are other things that are like, you know, trouble and style, which are things you kind of gain and then can spend later on. But
yeah, it's XP in 2 different flavors, kind of.
Exactly right. I'm like, I kind of get those. And then like disaster and doom, I know what those kind of will be. The one that is something that is relatively new to me is the nope.
Oh, yeah, the nope. So in Blades in the Dark, you have this thing called a resistance. It's like basically what it is it makes it's instead of like in D&D, you'd have an armor class or a saving throw, right? In Blades in the Dark, it's you have a lot more, and in Slug Blaster, you basically have like your character, you as a player, have narrative control over what bad things happen to you. You don't get to choose if bad things happen. You can sometimes choose what bad things happen, right? So in Slug Blaster, noping, basically anytime you take a slam, you know, if there's a problem and the GM decides it's a slam, so it's damage to you or your gear or some sort of thing that is affecting your body or mind or spirit as a character, you can choose to nope it, you just say the word nope, and then you describe how your character avoids that thing. So if you got the GM says you get, you know, you fall off your hoverboard and break your ankle, you can say nope and describe yourself like rolling, you know, through the dirt instead. And or if you get hit with a psionic, you know, mind blast, you can say nope and describe how you quickly just pictured a bowl of lemons as hard as you could to, you know, fend off the attack or whatever psionics work. And yeah, and or, you know, anything like that. Then what you have to do is you have to mark 2 trouble. So trouble, as we talked about, gotcha. It's like, you know, it's like, you know, this is not a religiously accurate term, but it's sort of understood in the common knowledge. It's like a karma, like a bad karma thing, right? I think most white people sort of feel like they understand what that means, so it's a good way to explain it. It's
evil, so, XP.
Yeah, exactly. So you can say no to the slam, but then you're taking trouble, and trouble is going to result in problems later, right? You're going to build up that score. Something bad is going to happen to you later. So it's just what it does is it allows you to sort of choose how the bad stuff's going to look for your character, right? You get some sort of say in that. Yeah, so that's what it is. It's like this sort of flexible saving throw that you get to just choose to do.
And Lena, in your experience, how often do players nope a slam?
It depends, I suppose, how often the GM will create a consequence with a slam.
All the time.
Listener, Brian is slamming his fist into his palm with a threatening face.
Elliot, I remember our season of the Wild Sea. You gave a lot of cut. And boy, howdy, am I coming back.
I like this. I like this vibe. Absolutely. Because, like, the first mini piece of advice as a GM,
yeah,
you can
please
go harder than you think.
Yes.
Nice.
Especially as the run progresses and you're getting close to the climactic event of the run. If they're facing the big monster, dole out those slams. And the thing about slams is that in most cases, your players will have two slam boxes. So they can take two slams. If they take a third, they are out. So eventually it's going to get to a point where the player will have no choice but to nope the slam if they want to stay in the game.
Right.
And sometimes they will want to nope those slams preemptively, depending on the nature of the slam. If it's like, oh, your hoverboard is glitching and it may be on the fritz, they might be like, nah, I don't want my hoverboard to be on the fritz. Nope. quite often I found nopes are deployed because we also deploy slams very often.
Hell yeah.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. That is by far the biggest sort of mistake people make when they first start playing Slug Blaster is they go too easy, and the players too. The player, like both the GM and the players, often play too defensively at first. You both got to go hard. Like, you don't have to hold anything back. You don't have to save those resources because you can go hard. Then the players have to go hard too. Because so many times what happens is after a first session, people will be like, oh, I don't really have very many style points or trouble points at the end of the session. And it's because they weren't trying for enough tricks. Then they also weren't noping things. But usually that's because the GM wasn't giving them things to nope, right?
Right.
And as a GM, you can go really hard. Like, there's a piece of advice in Blades in the Dark that I just love, which is just like, what Fortune in the Dark does and like what John Harper did with Blades in the Dark is he gave the players like so much the player characters have so much power, like really, that even though the game is like so punishing and is base and almost unwinnable, every battle is very winnable, even if the war isn't in Blades in the Dark, right? So like there's a part where he says, like, you know, go hard, like firebomb their lair while they're sleeping. Like, he wants the GM to do like nasty things. Because he says they'll scramble, they'll spend resources, they'll trigger flashbacks, which is a Blaze in the Dark mechanic, like, and they'll figure it out like pretty easily, right? And that's where the fun is making them sweat, right? So in Slug Blaster, you can do the same thing. You can put them in these. One thing I love to do is I love to put my players in a situation that I don't even know the answer to, right? Like, because then it's actually really fun to see, like, okay, like, what are you going to do? This monster swallowed you. You're inside there, you know, like, what are you going to do? And they always figure it out, right? And it's,
that's such a good thing to remember. They always figure it out.
So you can go really hard. Now watch us. Like, we've we pushed that so hard that like your first session is somehow a
the
TPK,
first Slug Blaster TPK
ever.
Right, we're doing a funeral in episode two.
You're like, the dinosaur bites your head off. What do you do?
I guess I die.
No, but see, that's actually it. Is like truly. You could say that. You could say the dinosaur bites your head off, and then according to the rules, the player could say nope and describe their character narrowly avoiding right. that.
My,
right?
my helmet fact, is too yeah. strong and it yeah. breaks the dinosaur's teeth. And
now that's like sort of the ideal is to give them a situation that's kind of a tricky choice, right? So that's not like the ideal thing to do because there's no choice there. They're just going to say nope. But it is sometimes effective and funny to do that. And I do it all the time. Like I love having moments where I just want to go like with some sort of shocking, like sci-fi, you know, like real Rick and Morty shit, you know, where it's sure. like, where I have, like, I just want to have a teenager get evaporated or whatever. And then knowing well that they'll have to say nope. I do that. Okay. I pull that out maybe once per campaign, but it can be fun. So
that's fun.
All right, Elliot.
Yeah, I'm scared. I'm a little scared. I'm a little scared about what Brian...
This is great advice of, like, going to art, because it feels really fitting for, like, skate culture of, like, you have to commit to the trick. You have to commit to the bit. Yeah. Like, because if you don't, you're going to get hurt way worse than if you try to, like, push as hard as you can.
Yeah.
Tell that to my right shoulder. I did not commit to that drop-in, and did not work out well for me, so... Yeah, you gotta commit. You gotta commit.
Yeah, you're gonna get hurt anyway.
Yeah,
there you go. Might as well look cool doing it.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, exactly.
Midnight Muscadines is a cozy, dark tabletop role-playing game where light and shadow intertwine in a fractured world. Players take on the roles of Marmiteers, brave adventurers who journey into the untamed wildernight to collect the elusive Midnight Muscadines, craft magical jams, and protect the fragile light of Nim. Through collaborative storytelling and resourceful gameplay, players weave tales of courage, community, and the pursuit of balance. Will you preserve the light, uncover the truths hidden in the shadows, or reshape the balance of the world forever? Midnight Muscadines is perfect for fans of Studio Ghibli and Sea of Stars who seek to capture the magic of exploration and the heartfelt adventure in a world where small heroes make a big impact. Play Midnight Muscadines as a traditional GM'd game, GM-less, or even solo. Midnight Muscadines is crowdfunding now on BackerKit. Join the campaign at pandeongames.com/muscadines.
I'm Quinns of tabletop role-playing game review show Quinns Quest, and this is Play to Find Out. Play to Find Out is an actual play podcast that brings notorious old games from the 80s and 90s back to the table. Each season of Play to Find Out, I'm joined by Emily Johnson and Rob Morgan.
Good? Nervous?
Yeah.
You both looked at each other really concerned, like you think what's about to happen is going to be unpleasant. And frankly, I think that's rude.
And together, we explore the TTRPGs of ages gone by. Our goal? To separate the TTRPGs that deserve to be remembered from those that maybe don't.
Can I
don't know, Emily. It was the 80s.
Also,
a lot of people were on cocaine. We blow the dust from decrepit systems to learn how they work.
Your 100 on the encounter table bursts out. Right, you've encountered a bug. Get ready. Don't laugh.
How does one get ready for a fog?
Don't laugh.
Encounter their unique quirks.
I do finger guns to cover up how I wince.
A weird thing happens as you do finger guns.
Oh, no.
And I'm hoping that the Quinns Quest community will join us in exploring these games too. If you f*** this up, cannot describe to you how much your adventure ends here.
Yeah, that's fair.
Because the best way to learn is to play to find out.
Play to Find Out is available now on the Quinn's Quest Patreon, but the first episode of each series streams for free on the Quinn's Quest YouTube channel and wherever you get your podcasts. Anyway, you failed the Earth Tech roll, so, and you made jokes while I was doing my exposition, so you don't get to hear any more.
No. Come on.
I was shooketh.
So I want to get into some just like general advice stuff and especially talk to Lena a bit more. Brian, is there anything else mechanical you want to dig in on before we do that?
Yeah, I think the one other thing, I think that the runs are things that I'm going to feel pretty good with. Like that kind of feels like classic adventure. It's going to be different. It's going to be wacky, but I'm like, I'm good for that. Some of the downtime stuff is also still stuff I'm familiar with, but I'm just like, It always is a slight hitch in my giddy up, I think, is the downtime type stuff. So, yeah, I'd love to hear some advice on like how best to handle when you're no longer on a run and when you're doing the downtime activities and you're like dealing with your family and your friends back in your hometown.
You got this. You're going to be great then, because downtime flows. Like it's going to be totally good. Lena can talk more about this, but I think the thing about downtime is, you know, it's so freeform. It's mechanically simple and there's not really very many moving parts to it. It's just telling stories, right? And that can sometimes be obviously very intimidating stuff, but I will say, there is something about playing a game in which you play teenagers that makes this stuff so easy for almost everybody. Everyone knows these stories so well because they're just like one of the most common like types of media, right? Like, and we've been watching this stuff from when we were kids all the way into adulthood. We've been watching stories about kids, right? And we've all been kids.
We've
so,
all been there.
Yeah, it really goes pretty smoothly, I would say, for most people. And, you know, it's going to depend on you and your fellow player's style, how deep role-playing you go or versus sort of narrating it and stuff like that. But I think, I don't know. Mechanically, there's really nothing to worry about. And I find that most people just take to it. But Lena, you probably have some actual advice, not just pat on the back.
Not just
your
boy,
lunch.
Howdy, this game was designed well.
Oh, yeah. Like, this is...
My advice, honestly, it's how we run downtime in Quantum Kickflip. I recommend it to every table, and it feels like cheating with your players, because there's two sort of main downtime tracks. There's a family-based downtime track, and then there's an angst-based downtime track, which is a little bit more internal and can also affect the crew. But with a downtime track like family, or ones where they may interact with, you know, external figures, you know, parents and such, let them create that NPC. Let them go to the lengths of like, you know, what is their mom like, or their guardian or their older brother? And then what we do in Quantum Kickflip is the GM doesn't voice that character.
Okay.
Another player takes on that character. And it works so well for so many reasons. Less work as a GM. You've already had to do so many characters and like monsters and mechanics. And if you had to play the family member for every single downtime, first of all, you're doing so much legwork. And secondly, that means like four other people have to wait their turn. So it gets everyone else gets their hand on the ball a little bit more. The story becomes more collaborative because everyone needs to have this understanding of what this character's mom is like. And you can always like collude as GM and be like, hey, I'm thinking for the downtime scene, it would be cool if they went in this direction, and you can like have those discussions beforehand. But yeah, it feels like a cheat code.
I love that.
What's great about that too, Lena, is that like you said, like as a GM, you can, you know, you can say maybe, but and that's exactly it. When it comes to so much of this stuff, you know, everyone has different amounts of this. I know that you guys do like put a lot like the GM, you and Robin, both in your separate seasons, you did have like a big sort of like a plot in your head that you're working on, like a master mm-hmm. plot. But what you weren't doing is plotting. You weren't plotting the actual player's character stuff. You were plotting what the world is doing, and that's what you should be doing. Like the players have authorship over their characters' arcs.
Yes.
You can give ideas, but you're giving ideas as another player would, right? You're just like, you're writer's rooming it, but you as the GM shouldn't really even think of yourself as having any more authorship over that than another player would. So the players should be in charge of telling their own stories and having their own, you know, in the same way, like they should have their own goals and motivations, and they should be the ones like coming up with run ideas, and like it should be a proactive thing, right? It's all about like they should act and then the GM reacts, and then the GM mm-hmm. throws something to them and then they have to react, and you're just passing it back and forth. And as the GM, you should be like playing the world as if it was like your character, right? And put all your planning and prep into that, like thinking about like, hey, what is this faction doing right now? What would they want to do with this? Or like, what would this mm-hmm. like evil NPC be thinking about and scheming right now? And you're trying to think of that stuff, and that's your domain, right?
Right.
And then the player's relationship with, you know, with her mom, that can be between her and, if you go this route, the other player who's playing her mom, like during those scenes, however your group wants to handle that. Right. Or a lot of times when I run it, like I've never done it the way the Quantum Kickflip crew did with all the players sort of playing each other's family members. I've never run it that way, even though it sounds amazing. But usually in that case, I'm playing the NPCs, but I still really try to let them take the lead as to what they want the scene to be like. And then I just sort of, I'm just playing support, right?
In my experience GMing, when it comes to downtime scenes, and you know, we're talking about, okay, I want to take this trouble at home beat, I've had it range anywhere from someone being like, this is how I see the scene playing out, and then we play out the scene. Or I've had them be like, I want to take the trouble at home beat, and then they just like set it up and go. If they're like that confident in what they want it to be. I've also occasionally had players be like, I want to take this trouble at home beat. I like have the trouble for it, and I feel like it fits right now in the character's arc, but I don't know what that looks like. It's the beat I want to take. I don't know what it looks like. And then that's the most work I've ever had to do as a GM in a downtime scene, is like help generate those ideas. And sometimes I get that player in on it, or sometimes if it's at a point where it feels like it needs to be more maybe blindsiding to the character, or more unexpected for the character, then I might play those cards a little bit closer to the chest, and then maybe get the other NPC player in on it. But through the whole thing, I think Mikey hit the nail on the head that it is a very player-driven process and a very collaborative process under that scope.
And Lena, correct me if I'm wrong, but you know, Quantum Kickflip, it's a very like produced podcast, like well edited and stuff like that. I feel like a lot of times there is some amount of like a little bit of pre-discussion before you launch into those scenes that sometimes you edit out of the final show. Like
100%. I would say 100% of the time.
Yeah, so and so depending on, you know, this is going to be like, I think that's a absolutely great idea for an actual play to do. I also like that sometimes you have shown little bits of that just to like, it's like your podcast is not meant to educate people, it's meant to entertain, but it does also educate people. And so I like those little moments sometimes too. But I think that's it. Like in a home game where you're not, you know, trying to present like a sort of a really like nice flowing performance or something, you're just all friends hanging out together, there'll be a lot more of that, like, of like, I was thinking that maybe it'll go like this and stuff, and then you mm-hmm. might dive in, and then it might just sort of organically turn into role playing. Or there also might be times where people just don't have the energy to role play in character, and they'll just be like, I'm taking this, I think this is where you would see my character have an argument with my with his mom. Maybe it'd be through a window and you wouldn't even hear what they're saying, and then he goes into his room, slams the door. Like, they just sort of want to just like, let's quickly narrate it, and let's, you know, I'm telling you that that's what's happening. You know, it depends on the energy level of the room and the talents and inclinations of the players and stuff like that, how it plays out.
There's a word in there that came up, that comes up in, I think, every one of these conversations, and it is prep and preparation for a session. And I think, Lena, I want to direct this question specifically at you, because you're in a similar position to Brian, where you prep not only for a session of Slug Blaster, but you prep for an actual play session of Slug Blaster, which can be different. For you, what are the key pieces of preparation for a Slug Blaster session?
For me, I tend to break it down into sort of three key categories that I want to fill: premise, goal, obstacle. So the premise might be, we're searching for components in the Golden Jungle dimension. The goal might be finding ways to upgrade the gear. And the obstacle is a rival crew gets in the way. For example, so I try to sketch out those beats first, because that kind of creates the skeleton for the run that I want to do. One thing I will say is you can always prep less than you think you need to.
Yes, this is all good news.
Problems are big. Not necessarily that, like, you have to map out every single thing that might happen should someone roll a 4 or 5, because you can't possibly predict who's going to roll when and what the outcome of the roll is going to be. But if, for example, my players are facing off against a Cerulean Gloomfly, I'm going to write the kick-ass description of the Cerulean Gloomfly. And then I'm just going to be like, what are all the things that could happen if they roll a 1 through 5, because 5 times out of 6, that's what's going to happen. And come up with a list of, like, snag-like problems, like what are the things that might hold them back. There's 2 more Cerulean Gloomflies. And then what are the direct slams that can hit them? Within that as well, or I guess not within that, but sort of within the broader scope of the run, usually a couple of set pieces with a couple of those, like, little obstacles in the way.
Sure.
So if they're, you know, in the Golden Jungle dimension, they come across, you know, the ruined landscape, and then they're in the gulch, and then they find the Gundam that has the components. Like, that could be a way that it's broken down.
Hell yeah.
That doesn't sound too bad.
That doesn't sound too bad.
Whenever I prep, I just always focus on the things that I know I'm terrible at thinking of in the moment. So if there's something I'm like really bad at thinking up, like, you know, names or, you know.
Oh, yes. The list of names is many.
You know, tech jargon, whatever type of thing that, like, I'm like, I never want to think this up in the moment. Or a lot of times what I'll do, and I know, Lena, you do this too, is I will prep, like, an introductory paragraph for, like, a new location, because I just want to really set the scene with some, like, pow and zing, with something, like, you know, tight and pre-written that, you know, describes their new location or something. That's what I like to do. You definitely don't have to. I don't do that in, like, really casual games, but if I want to, you know, if I'm trying to impress.
I love writing a monologue.
Yeah, you know, you want to, like, do that, you know. But yeah, a big list of problems. That's why in the book that you can find a list of problems in, like, all over the book in different places. Like, every world will have a list of problems. Every monster will have a list of problems. And then there's just extra tables in the back of problems, because those are the things that are exhausting, like, start really sapping your brain as a GM. It's just like, oh, I have to think of another, like, you know,
they happen like 85% of the game. is problems and reckoning with those problems.
And it can feel, you can feel pressure to have to, like, where, like, every problem someone rolls has to result in, like, some, like, you know, Spielbergian, like, clever sort of twist and, like, you know, like heightening of the scene. And that is obviously the ideal, is, you know, like, oh, I grab onto the vine and, oh no, the vine's a snake, you know, like that kind of stuff. Like, that's the ideal, but you can't do that all the time. You're gonna burn everyone out, and especially yourself.
Sometimes there's just got to be two Math Panthers instead of one.
Exactly. Well, that's what, if you just have some easy things like that, that are like go to, like, oh yeah, like more monsters are here, or even just like a slam, like it's okay just to damage the player. If you can't think of, if you've already in the scene, if you've already had the more Math Panthers show up, if you've already had like, and now the water is rising as well. You know, if you've already done a couple of things that made the scene like as heightened as you can, at that point, just start hitting them with slams. Like, that's the time that the bites start happening, because you'll be tired of thinking of like, you can't heighten the scene much more anyways. So now it's time to, like, for the pain to actually arrive. And then also, if you're completely torched, you can always just take bite, and you can, which is basically means, you're just saving a problem for yourself for later to give them. Like, it's basically that mechanic almost like entirely came about for me playtesting, just being like, okay, problem, I'll get back to you on that. Like, and then making a little mark on a sheet to be like, I have to do something bad to this player soon, but I can't think of it right now. Right. And that's what taking bite is you can just stockpile these little points. And that way, you know, when you think of something really good, you can just be like, oh yeah. And then this happens. Right. So, so having your problems, like, have a big list of them prepped is a great idea.
So, but before we circle back to Brian, to see how he's feeling as we wrap to a close, there's a question I want to ask both of you as two of the people most familiar with this game. That's kind of a fun one. Is there something in this book that you haven't seen used, or you haven't gotten a chance to use, that you just would really love us to take advantage of in this series?
With the book, as a GM, I would most often go to the world's pages, the factions pages, and the monster pages to generate inspiration. If we're going to the underwater plane, what has already been written about the underwater plane that I can draw from? If they're going to encounter a big monster, what monster exists in the book already that I can potentially use? Or do I want to create something? And in thinking about those three categories, the worlds, the monsters, and the factions, something that I haven't seen that I am deeply, morbidly curious about is the Omnimouth Horde.
The Omnimouth Horde?
Brian, close your ears. Brian, close your ears.
I heard Omni Mouth
sounds
Horde.
Like.
I've never seen that used either, actually. You're right.
I want to see it so bad. I'm not a horror person. I don't like watching horror movies, but the moment a little bit of, like, creepy, upsetting undertones start to happen in a game, I'm like, yeah, let's go. So I have like morbid fascination with the Omnimouth Horde.
Yeah, that was a monster written by Michael Elliott. So I actually had, when I was getting near the end and I was sweating the deadline I'd already blown by like a year, I reached out to both Robin, Lena's partner, and another designer I know named Michael Elliott to do some writing for the game. And then because I'm crazy and this was my baby, I ended up basically using a tiny, tiny fraction of what they wrote, and rewriting half of that too. Not because it wasn't good, but just because really making this game was fun for me, and I realized I didn't want anyone like making it for me. I wanted to do it. I wanted to do it. I was like, oh no, I want to write this. Why did I ask them to write this? But some of it remains, and it's all so good. And the Omnimouth Horde is one of the things that Michael Elliott wrote.
Thank you for this gift, Michael Elliott.
And I think it's an homage to a Stephen King book or short story, if I'm remembering right, but I haven't read it, but that's how I think he mentioned that. So
I've read it. I don't want us to say any more so that Elliot doesn't know anything.
Yeah. I don't want it to be spoiled, but I am deeply terrified.
That's really good. Oh, the things I like that don't get used enough are, speaking of monsters, are Solitons. I actually haven't decided how I want to pronounce that. But basically they're like just like big, like weird mystical beings or like gods in Slug Blaster. The things formed out of like dimensional, like probability glitches. And I just like, I've always imagined a little more arcane, a little more magic in Slug Blaster than ended up in the final book. But I am making an expansion that will take care of that. But, you know, I've always imagined a little bit more, you know, like lots of like psionics and that kind of stuff. And so the Solitons are like, I would love, yeah, like I always just picture, do you guys remember from Adventure Time, the like party god? He's like this giant wolf head.
Yes.
I just always have this image of like something like that, like a giant wolf head, crazy looking thing, like zooming, like chasing Slug Blasters across the landscape, like opening its mouth, like shooting lasers out at them, like just a crazy like being like that. And it's usually always a giant head that just sort of floats around shooting. I always feel like those don't get used enough, even by me. I think I don't use them enough because I picture them as like, you know, quote unquote, like epic level monsters, even though there's nothing in Slug Blaster that there's no like levels in Slug Blaster, but I always just like think I'm like, oh, I can't use this yet. Like, this is like, you know, this is like a CR20 monster. so I always like hold off on it, but they're fun. And the few times I've used them, they're fun. And they can be fun because they can start as a fight and then like turn into a philosophical conversation or some sort of weird, that's always my favorite stuff in Slug Blaster is the stuff like, I also like the world Quahalia, which is like the weird trippy world, because you can always like anything where you end up like, you know, walking through your own like memories or something like that is always like a great storytelling situation for players, because they can like really, you know, develop their character in cool ways and show cool things, right? And so I like with Solitons, because there can be moments where, you know, the Soliton like forces you to reveal your core truth or something like that, and then the player gets to is confronted with having to fill that gap, right? So
Mikey, I know you're trying to inspire Brian, but you are lighting something up in my brain.
Perfect. Excellent.
Oh, I'm not gonna be able to sleep tonight.
Honestly, yeah. I'm feeling pretty good myself. Yeah.
taking notes.
This was actually just a trick. This is the start of your new podcast.
Oh yeah.
Wow. Oh, I'm excited. I'm feeling good. Other than my deep-seated terror over whatever the Omnimouth drones are.
Don't worry about it. It's probably not going to come up.
Brian, the real question is, this isn't about me. How are you feeling coming to the end of this conversation about getting ready to Slugmaster in the coming weeks?
I'm feeling pretty good. The rules don't scare me. I don't think they ever scared me. But I was just like, I'm not fluent in them yet. And that's just going to be a thing that will take time. But I think after hearing all these stories, I'm kind of like, okay, I've done all these. I've done these rules in different dialects. You know what I mean?
Yeah. A little less color.
Yeah, just it's just something slightly different. But no, I feel pretty good. I think the downtimey stuff I'm not too worried about. And then, I think it's just like finding those arcs. And I think the piece that I'm really keeping in my head is like, focus on the world and like let that have an arc and let the players focus on their own arcs. Because like ultimately that like they're here to play and they're like they want to do that. I need to worry about that from kind of like a broad perspective, but also like that's their job. Like they're gonna do it, and they're like the game motivates them to do it with its mechanics. So just let them kind of lean on it.
It's so healthy to let go in that way. Like that's been my arc as a GM, and sort and it very much mirrors like just also personal lessons for myself. But like of just I was always a very controlling GM and always sort of a perfectionist, and that resulted in me really railroading my players all the time and like telling the story for them and stuff. And I found that I was just getting so stressed doing that. And then I actually had a therapist tell me, cause I was, you know, about like my sort of perfectionism and control stuff, control, like anxiety and stuff. She was like, suggested I like take some improv classes. And I told her, well, I kind of already do that. I play like role-playing games. And she was like, oh, great. Keep doing that. And don't prep as much. Like basically she told me. And I thought like, okay, so that's when I really, started GMing like that of like,
yeah,
okay, I'm gonna, like this is all them. Like I have my bag of little tricks, but I'm going to go in with no plan. I'm going to go in with prep, but no plan. And I started figuring out the difference, right, of that. Like I'm going to have all my tools here, all my bookmarks, but I'm not going to. I don't have any actual plan. And so when I found Blades in the Dark, and that. You know, that game really supports that style of play. Whereas something like D&D, you can do it that way, but it is just harder because there's just, you know, you do kind of have to prep encounters and stuff unless you're really good, which a lot of people are. And I've gotten better at that myself even. But the Forged in the Dark games are very much built for that kind of play. And that's why I really ended up taking to them. And when I wrote Slugblaster, I tried to even, you know, amp that aspect up as much as I could and make it as easy as possible for me or a GM just like me to just jump in and really freestyle a session and it to still be sort of fun, because then you can enjoy it as a GM, right? You get to play too, right?
Slugblaster solidified me as a GM. I had DM'd D&D a few times, and like, you know, I was okay at it. And you know, when we started season one of Quantum Kickflip, I wouldn't have thought that I would have had what it takes, I suppose, to GM a whole season. And then we started talking about season two, and I started getting ideas, and I was like, not only do I think I can GM, I really want to do this. Slugblaster is such a great intuitive game to GM.
Hell yeah. That's great. Mikey, Lena, thank you so much for coming to the show, for all of the advice and the stories. You've really kind of like lit my brain up about the game. I'm sure, Brian, you feel the same way.
Oh, yeah.
It's going to be a great season. We really appreciate you both taking the time. Do you want to let our listeners know where they can find each of you, and Lena, where they can find Quantum Kickflip?
You can find Quantum Kickflip anywhere that you can find your podcasts. We are hosted by Podbean. We have season one and season two fully available. We also have a Patreon if you want to support us. And we do have a season three in the works.
Woo! Yeah!
Yes! So stay tuned for that.
So good. Yeah, and you can find, if you go to Wilkie's Candy Lab, that's the name of my little game company. If you go to that.com, you can find like links to the Discord, which is, I'm pretty proud of the little Discord I got. We have a lot of people in there like making games and having fun. You know, it's a very fun focused Discord. And you can also check out, get links to Slugblaster and my other game, Two Hand Path there. And yeah, and I'm on Blue Sky. I sometimes talk about like what fast food I'm eating there and stuff. And so
what social media was meant for.
Yeah, that's right. You know, I do that. And I also try to give like talk about my game design process here and there and stuff too. And yeah, that's it.
That's great. We'll put all those links in the show notes. And I got to personally shout out Quantum Kickflips being a rad ass actual play show. So if you're hearing this interview and you can't wait the 2 weeks that it'll take to get to the next episode, Quantum Kick, how many episodes do you guys have right now? Two seasons, but it's like,
oh my gosh,
60.
We have two seasons and each season is 36 episodes.
Okay, so you got a cool 72
so if you
episodes
start right now. You might finish before the episode comes out.
And don't stop.
Don't stop. Don't sleep.
Don't stop. Yeah,
you got to put it on that 2x speed and you got to go to sleep with the AirPods.
Yeah, no, turn us into little chipmunks.
Oh, no, actually, I can't even say that as a joke. I can't even say 2x speed as a joke. We listen to podcasts on 1x in this house.
Be very clear, if anyone listens to my first dungeon on even 1.5x speed, get out right now.
Ooh,
listenership drops by 50%
I spent
tomorrow.
Too much time sound designing this show for someone to chipmunkify it.
Oh,
good.
Well, thank you both so much for coming. We're gonna put all those links in the show notes below, and that is all for this episode of My First Dungeon, Slug Blaster. Join us next week for our Session Zero as we meet a group of teenagers hoping to kickflip their way into the quantum history books, or at least make a rad video along the way. And remember, if you're having fun, you're already doing it right. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
If you're hearing this, that means you listened to every last second of this episode. If you're not caught up yet, that's great, because then there's plenty more to listen to. But if you are caught up and you simply can't wait for the next episode, then you should head on over to patreon.com/myfirstdungeonpod and become a member of the Dice Pool. For just a few bucks a month, you'll get cast talkbacks, original games, and a full-length bonus actual play each and every month. As of the end of 2023, there is already over 20 hours of bonus audio, plus a whole bunch of other goodies to enjoy. So head on over to patreon.com/myfirstdungeonpod and jump into the Dice Pool. We'll see you there.